I will now call the fourth and final case set for oral argument on today's oral argument calendar. That's case number A23-389, Betty Lou Gooby Slag v. David Allen Slag. That is the caption of the appeal, which I believe comes from the caption of the district court proceeding. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The lectern is adjustable in height. There's a button on the front ledge that will move it up or down if you wish. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Nixon, and I'm here representing the appellant, Ms. Betty Gooby. And the district court erred here in its judgment in a number of ways, specifically finding that the party's antenuptial was valid and in a number of ways in dividing the party's property. Therefore, should be reversed in its entirety. For the sake of time, I intended to focus today on the antenuptial agreement and specifically the district court's finding that the antenuptial was procedurally fair, most telling by those common law factors, but I'm happy to clarify any items on any other aspects of the case if the court has questions.
Ms. Nixon, before you get into those issues that you just mentioned, I'm wondering if I can, if the lectern, so the button is on the front ledge of the slanted area, do you see that? There's a,
yeah. Okay. There we go.
If you wish, you seemed to be interested in that. So I guess I'm interested in the practical consequences of the antenuptial agreement or its enforcement. In other words, you know, what would the result have been in the division of property but for that? And it's helpful for me to look at the spreadsheet that's at addendum 60. Do you mind looking at pulling that out? Because I just want to be to understand. I mean, so am I correct in assuming or in perhaps inferring a bit? I'll wait until you have it up.
I'm assuming that you're looking at one of the schedules. Is that?
It's Exhibit A,
yes.
Schedule
okay.
1.
Yes, I can see that.
You have it. Okay. So am I correct in assuming that, so in the top category, bank accounts, investments, and so on, the second from the bottom and the third from the bottom in that category, that appears to be two assets where they were entirely deemed non-marital. Am I correct in assuming that those are the only two assets that were treated differently because of the antenuptial agreement, or am I wrong about that? And if so, please explain.
So I would point the court to the two exhibits in the antenuptial where the great majority of Mr. Slag's assets were actually listed and none were listed for Ms. Gooby.
I understand. And then, of course, I mean, over the years, I take it they changed form and there was some tracing done by the neutral expert. But I guess I'm kind of, and I see on Exhibit A to the antenuptial, there's six assets which add up to about $900,000, roughly.
Yes.
And I'm just kind of wondering, where do those assets appear on the spreadsheet that is at addendum 60?
You know, I'd have to compare to be absolutely accurate here as to which were still in existence at the time of the divorce. I think the factors under that Kinney case are really the most telling here because the court really erred in analyzing those factors.
I asked my question as sort of a preface to your legal arguments, but I just kind of want to understand sort of like the particular consequence. It sounds like Judge Cochran may have a...
Perhaps if we are to look at exhibits 38 and 39, those are were prepared by the neutral expert, and one shows the division if it was as you know, if the antenuptial agreement was not in effect, I believe, and the other shows if it was, is that correct, 38 and 39?
Yes.
So you can see in 38 that there would have been approximately 1.257 million allocated to each for marital assets under 38, and then I think 39 shows the division with the antenuptial in effect.
Yes, and those two exhibits did show the difference. So I think that would be a correct place to really see that practical difference.
I think what Judge Johnson was getting at is if you look at all the assets that were potentially, you know, at issue here, what is the difference between if the antenuptial is valid versus not valid?
Mm-hmm. And I think, and that,
correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Johnson.
Right, and I guess knowing the dollar amounts is interest is valuable information for me. Also, I guess I'm wondering how many of the accounts or items listed at Addendum 60 were implicated by the antenuptial. And I'm wondering if it's only two. Perhaps there's a third one, which is the fifth one in order. Most of that item was deemed non-marital, but that could have been for reasons other than the antenuptial. I don't know.
That would have been the, I believe that is the mutual funds account where my client would argue that the income there was improperly analyzed by the district court.
Okay.
You mean whether it's a capital distribution or income?
Right, yes. Whether those capital gains distributions were considered, should have been considered appreciation or income. Yes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your answer, and I apologize for interrupting, but now I'll let you begin go back to where you were.
Sure. And I think in looking at the procedural fairness here, because the antenuptial here addresses both marital and non-marital property, it must meet both those statutory and common law factors of procedural fairness. Most telling here is the balancing test of those common law factors. And I think that in reviewing these factors, the most weighty are the lack of consideration for Ms. Gooby, the lack of knowledge of the particulars of the agreement, and the lack of fair and full disclosure. These three factors are weighty enough to for this court to reverse and remand on the finding that the antenuptial was procedurally fair.
You're not saying that he didn't disclose things, are you?
No. Well, in looking at those two exhibits, again, to the antenuptial, the great majority of his assets were listed in that exhibit.
So you're not saying he didn't disclose things. You're just saying that hers were not disclosed.
Hers were not disclosed, yes. That is the argument here. That
he dispute what she claimed were assets?
Did he dispute as to whether or not he knew what her assets were?
Or what they were.
So he testified, actually, that if an asset was not listed on the antenuptial, he wouldn't have known what they were at all. And because that antenuptial didn't list any of her assets, I'd argue that testimony then means that he was testifying that he didn't know about any of her assets at the time.
But did he dispute what she said were her assets?
She didn't list. I guess I'm a bit confused.
During the dissolution, did she make a claim that there were premarital assets?
She did, yes. And
did he dispute those?
He did not dispute that those were premarital, but the issue was whether they were actually, there was a full and fair disclosure of those at the time that they signed that antenuptial.
Can you be more specific? What assets did she possess at the time of the agreement that should have been listed on Exhibit B but were not?
At the time, she had an investment account that an IRA account. That she had at the time that was not listed on the antenuptial. And I'd point out that it wasn't just that it wasn't listed on the antenuptial. As I said, the Mr. Slag testified that he didn't know essentially any of her assets.
How was she prejudiced by that?
I would argue that there wasn't fair and full disclosure because of that. So the way that the antenuptial...
But in terms of procedural fairness, how was that unfair to her? Isn't, you know, in terms of the appeal and our review of the district court's decision, isn't what's critical, whether she was aware of his assets. Why is his, I mean, I know that that's a factor, whether the parties, you know, knew about each other's assets, but I guess I'm wondering, you know, first of all, the district court, I think, found that they, you point to his testimony, but the district court, I think, found that taken all the, taken together all the testimony at trial, that they both were aware of each other's financial condition. But setting that aside, how was assuming, you know, there wasn't specific disclosure to him of all of her assets, how does it show that this agreement was procedurally unfair to her?
So I would point to the way that the antenuptial was written. It's the two exhibits aren't meant to list just all of the assets that they had at the time. The antenuptial specifically states that these are only the assets that are subject to the agreement. Right. And so by virtue of that, what happened is that all of Mr. Slagg's assets that he had at the time of the marriage were protected, whereas none of Ms. Gooby's were. And so I think that is absolutely an issue that she suffered because of that lack of disclosure.
But how did she suffer? In the disillusion, she was given credit for all the assets that she claimed she had premarital.
She was by virtue.
How was she prejudiced?
Yeah. I mean, was there any way that? There isn't any evidence that she was precluded from listing assets in the agreement.
There's not, but I think that actually goes more to the statement that Mr. Slagg had made, that Ms. Gooby was included in the conversation the entire time, right? That she was involved in the negotiation of the antenuptial. If she had been, it would have been entirely in her interest to list assets there that she would have subject to the agreement. However, she didn't, because she wasn't involved by her testimony.
Well, let's say that there wasn't a pre antenuptial agreement. How would it come out differently? How would it have been different?
So I think one of the major items was looking at the income in the accounts. That the way that the antenuptial was written, the income from Mr. Slagg's assets that were subject to the agreement was also excluded by the district court. And by doing that, that did prejudice Ms. Gooby.
Weren't those traceable to the premarital assets?
Some of them were traceable. However, I think that the court did err in a number of ways in tracing some of those. Excuse me, if I could get to that piece here. Specifically as to the annuity, in discrediting Ms. Gooby's expert, Mr. Kiwos, the district court relied heavily on an interaction that the district court found that Ms. Devitt, the neutral expert, had shared her screen, and she pointed to documentation that Mr. Kiwos failed to consider. Now, I thoroughly reviewed the transcript. I don't see that this interaction occurred. I see that Ms. Devitt did point out where her analysis was different, but the district court relied on that fairly significantly in finding that Mr. Kiwos was not credible. Mr. Kiwos also provided testimony that a withdrawal from a non-marital mutual fund was immediately reinvested, including documentation to show as much, but Ms. Devitt's schedules relying on this error were not corrected, and the district court relied on that in its schedule. So I think that there are errors in the way that the district court also analyzed those non-marital claims as to the income.
Ms. Nixon, the district court made a statement in its conclusions of law. I'm looking now at addendum 26, made a statement that respondent paid for the majority of the party's needs while living together and during the marriage. First of all, do you agree with that as a factual matter? And secondly, isn't that relevant to the issue of consideration?
I don't agree with that as a factual matter. Ms. Gooby did not testify to that. She testified that Mr. Slag did handle the finances. She didn't testify that he paid for a significant amount of the party's items. So I would argue that that was erroneous.
Is there other evidence of that?
Other evidence that
other
Mr.
evidence
Slag
that
had.
He paid for the majority of the party's living expenses?
There was not. It was just the testimony of the parties.
Well, that's what I mean. Was there other evidence besides your client's testimony that he did not? Was there evidence that he did?
There was not evidence of that. For the most part,
did he testify to that?
Did he testify to that? I believe that he did. So that's why I say I believe that it is only the testimony of the parties.
Okay, and the district court found that credible. Apparently,
the district court apparently did find that credible. Yes.
But isn't that relevant to consideration?
Whether he had paid for the parties. Finances during the marriage?
And the district court said while living together and during the marriage, and I think referring to both the cohabitation period as well as the marriage.
I think in looking at the issue of consideration, I'd actually point out that I think that was the most egregious error here. In looking at that, the district court was to examine whether the, according to Kramer, whether the financially disadvantaged spouse was provided for. And here, the district court didn't look at that. They didn't look at what she received in exchange for giving up all of these items, all of her rights to Mr. Slag's assets upon divorce. The court appeared to rely on the Hafner case, as does Mr. Slag, which was decided well before Kinney and Kramer. In that case, the court focused exclusively on if a wife had freely entered into the contract, if she knew the terms when she signed, and if she was a reasonably intelligent and experienced person. And that's what the court really hung its hat on here in the judgment and decree, was whether she was a reasonably intelligent and experienced person. But looking at the antenuptial itself, she simply wasn't provided for. And I think that the court finding that there was adequate consideration there was an egregious error.
So your initial allotment of time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Counsel for respondent, please, when you're ready, please identify yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. Katie Gendro here representing Mr. Slag, who is the respondent in this matter. The district court's order finding that the antenuptial agreement was valid, that the at-home revocation was invalid, and the district court's distribution of property based upon the valid antenuptial agreement was correctly decided and therefore should be affirmed in its entirety. First, as to the validity of the agreement, the district court's findings and the application of the law were directly in line with a litany of antenuptial cases determined by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in cases like Pollock, McKee, Hill, Kinney, and Kramer.
Was the district court's consideration of whether there was adequate consideration in line with Kramer, where I don't really see the district court analyzing what consideration wife received in exchange for signing the agreement. I just see the district court kind of analyzing whether they, whether wife was, understood the contract, but not what the actual consideration was. What was the benefit of the bargain?
In adequate consideration, it's really only a grain of sand that the court needs to consider, right, for consideration. And in this case, the court...
Well, what do you mean by a grain of sand?
I think it doesn't have to require
more than a grain of sand.
Certainly in contract, it's a grain of sand, but here in this context, it's more than a grain of sand. I think you're right, Your Honor. In this case, the parties agreed, or they looked at... we're given some guidance as to adequate consideration in Hafner at 259 Northwest 2nd, 567, where the parties...
But I think, as appellant pointed out, Hafner is an older case and Kramer is the relevant case. So can you address the standard enunciated in Kramer and how... What consideration did wife receive here?
Well, for example, the parties each continued to retain their non-marital interests in all of their assets. The Maple Grove home was, for example, a non-marital asset, and Ms. Gooby continued to maintain her non-marital interest in that asset. She could have sold her half interest. She could have given it to her children, which is directly contradictory to the statute upon marriage. So she has the ability to maintain her non-marital asset in that way.
Wouldn't she have maintained that without the antenuptial agreement?
She, not necessarily in the event of a divorce or in the event of a death. In the event of a death, particularly, Mr. Slag could have made a spousal claim against the estate in order to get her portion of that because they were married.
Could you, so I, as you heard, I asked your opposing counsel about that statement on page 26, that respondent paid for a majority of the party's needs while living together and during the marriage. Can you tell me more about that or about the evidence about that? And was it quantified by you or by the neutral expert? In other words, you know, what, how much that were their living expenses and how much did he pay and so on?
So with regard to the living expenses during the marriage, there is testimony that Mr. Slag himself did pay for a majority of the living expenses. Mr. Kiewis, the expert for Ms. Gooby, actually indicated based upon his document, which the appellant argues was marked as preliminarily, and as an aside note, we would argue that the preliminary marking of that document was not done by the court, but done by Mr. Kiewis in development of his own determination. When he looked at the income of the parties over the years, it was clear that Mr. Slag was the one who had the financial wherewithal and dipped into non-marital assets to pay for their lifestyle, as well as build the almost $800,000 home that they eventually did move into. Does that answer your question?
And during, I don't see in the record what's the party's current age, and during their marriage, during which parts of their marriage, or how much of the period of their marriage were either of them employed?
So the parties were married in their early 40s. Then I believe that they got married in 1995, and Ms. Slag continued to do her real estate business until early to mid-2000s. And after that, Mr. Slag then wound up his business in 2014. So starting in 2014, neither one of them were working. And they were just relying on Social Security income and retirement income.
Okay, so it sounds like the documents prepared by Mr. Kiewis, or Kiewis, excuse me for misremembering that, they provide some detail about the parties' earnings as well as the source of their payments of living expenses.
That's correct. Specifically, Exhibit 57, thanks to my co-counsel here, Mr. Kiewis' statement, Exhibit 57, identifies the total income of the parties and the sources of that income, and the income, the wages for Mr. Slag as well as Ms. Gooby. So that.
Can you tell me more about that? Just because I'm surprised I don't see those numbers in the district court's order, and it makes me curious, but it seems like that's naturally relevant to our consideration. I mean, what did he typically earn? What did she typically earn? How much did they spend?
Sure. So in Exhibit 57, the typical earnings based upon the tax return for 2004 was $125,000 total. And then starting in 2005, the income goes down quite a bit. $31,000, $43,000, $84,000. So it goes down quite a bit. And then it is further broken down in Exhibit 57 with the wages that Mr. Slag in 2004 had $12,800 worth of wages, and Ms. Slag had $8,000 worth of wages. There is some documentation in Mr. Kiewis' statement as to how they got that income, and it's further broken down in that Exhibit 57.
Okay, thank you.
And to that extent, Ms. Slay or Ms. Gooby did ultimately receive throughout the marriage the benefit of Mr. Slag's complete non-marital assets, and the lifestyle that she had during the marriage was much better than she would have had but for being married to Mr. Slag. With regard to the other testimony that we have here in determining whether or not this was fair and reasonable,
how is this situation, though, different from Kremer, where the husband came into the relationship with significant assets that increased in value over the course of the marriage, the wife came into the marriage with very little. If the agreement were enforced, she would leave the marriage with very little.
I think I understand what you're asking, Your Honor. In the Kremer case, the court, that's very different from this case because of the facts. The facts in the Kremer case indicated that wife was essentially put under duress to sign the document.
But duress is a separate consideration from adequacy of
that's
consideration.
True. Also, as far as the unforeseen circumstances that occurred in the Kremer matter, there was a new child that was born in that case. There is no new child here. The wife in Kremer did not work at all. She instead worked on the farm and supported the home. Here in the Slag and Gooby matter, there was no evidence that wife contributed substantially to the business of the husband. Instead, wife had her own real estate company and her own separate career. She could have continued to build that throughout the marriage, and that's very different from Kremer, because in Kremer, they did not live that lifestyle, and the wife was a stay-at-home wife. Further, the court...
So, I'm sorry, can I just interrupt? Is that case generally pronounced Kremer or Kremer?
We've been pronouncing it Kremer.
Okay, it probably is Kremer. I just wasn't sure.
I don't know when I was...
Okay. All right.
Respecting this court's recitation of the name. So.
No, I, you're more familiar with this area of practice than I am, so I appreciate that. So then what is your best argument that, that wife received adequate consideration for signing the antenuptial agreement?
Well, both of the parties were, it's well known that all parties have the freedom to contract, right? And Miss Gooby now, she ended up receiving the ability to continue to maintain her own separate assets, which included the IRA that was funded by Mr. Slag. And to Judge Smith's statement, there was no argument from Mr. Slag at the dissolution or the district court that Miss Slag was not entitled to her own non-marital estate. She also could have at any time amended her will to identify that her assets that were non-marital would go to her children. She did not do that, but she had the ability and freedom to do that at any time. She also continued to be in the same position as Mr. Slag, in that they both understood that they would be able to give their estates upon death to their children. That is not allowed under the statute. In a typical case where there is no antenuptial agreement, the parties would not necessarily be able to disinherit a spouse. In this case...
Is that true, though, here, where she didn't list any assets?
In this case, the court is...
The agreement only applies to the listed assets.
I disagree with that statement in the fact...
You do? Okay.
In the fact that the parties only have to have general knowledge of the assets.
The terms of the agreement, it says that
subject to this agreement in 1.1 A and B, only assets owned by which are subject to this agreement. Is that what this you're referring to, Judge?
Yeah, I thought there was some other language that... Well, the property that's, yeah, each party. Okay, I'll have to go back and look at it, but I was pretty sure that there was language that basically said that only the property listed was subject to the agreement.
I think that is referred to in Article 1.1A and B, where it says they fully and fairly disclose assets which are subject to this agreement.
Right.
And I think that language is a little bit contradictory to the language later in the statement that says that any assets that are non-marital are going to be remain the party's non-marital assets. But even that, the parties were attempting to memorialize assets that they intended to protect as part of the prenuptial agreement, not necessarily all assets that they have. They both had general knowledge of the fact that they both owned the Maple Grove home. They both had general knowledge of the fact that they each had vehicles. There was no objection or disagreement by the parties that they had to list every single nook and cranny in the entire home. They lived together for several years. They had a full understanding of the items that were contained within the home as well as other non-marital assets each other had. But it was
so help me understand then. I think I'm missing something. How if her, an asset of hers, such as the IRA, isn't listed, how does she retain the ability to dispose of that?
Because under the rights upon death, in addition to the rights upon dissolution of marriage, it does indicate that the parties are entitled to any of their assets that were non-marital and any earnings and income before that were related to assets that were owned by the parties before, during, and after the marriage. So it was a party's intention.
So 3.2, is that what you're referring to?
Let's see.
Oh, no, that's during marriage. You're talking about death.
Yes.
Okay.
It's under Article 3C, 3.7, each party shall have no right to the property or estate of the deceased party except authorized by wills, or except authorized by this agreement. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Well, I have questions as well. So like looking at 3B, which is on addendum 68, I'm unclear how does 3.6, for example, change how does it make a change vis-a-vis pre-existing law?
So this indicates that each party shall retain his or her own property free and clear of any claim of the other, which in the event of a death.
Well, this is dissolution or separation.
Sure. In the event of a dissolution or separation, the parties would then have to do some tracing to determine whether or not something was owned before or after the marriage. And as the district court properly stated, strict tracing is not required on that, and made a credibility determination that Mr. Slagg's testimony was more credible with regard to the non-marital assets.
So looking at the first line of 3.6, shall retain his or her property. I mean, if we interpret that to mean non-marital property, then doesn't paragraph 3.6 just describe the statutory and case law of Minnesota?
Well, not necessarily in the event that there's any gains or earnings related to that. So it's later further described down the line that any gains, income, or gains on those non-marital assets are going to be continue to remain non-marital.
And then going to the first page, paragraph 1.1C. So if the assets listed are not subject to this agreement, then what does that mean about 3.6? I mean, in other words, does 3.6 then not apply to his assets listed on Exhibit A?
Well, I think it's important to note that, as Judge Smith pointed out, that there were certain assets both parties knew about as being non-marital that were not listed here. There was no argument that the parties listed every single asset, and Mr. Slag consented to and agreed, and Ms. Slag, and both parties, 38 and 39.
I think you're answering a question I didn't ask. I'm just trying to understand how this agreement works, and but if 3.6 provides for certain treatment of certain property, and if 1.1C says that the agreement does not apply to the assets on Exhibit A, then does 3.6 have any, what's the significance of 3.6 with respect to the assets listed on Exhibit A?
Well, I think we need to further look at the fact that it says they shall be divided, assets shall be divided between the parties in proportion to the consideration provided by each, and any such assets that cannot be divided shall be sold, and the net proceeds attributable to each party's contribution shall be distributed to such party. So I understand that it's not perfect. These documents are never perfect, right? As we look at this, it says that it shall be dispersed in accordance with applicable law. The parties, as they were working with Ms. Devitt, agreed that certain assets were going to be non-marital and should not be divided as pursuant to the law, based upon the tracing and Ms. Devitt's investigation of the assets.
Thank you.
I see that my time is up.
Yeah. Thank you for your argument. Ms. Nixon, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. And I would like to point out a few aspects that that council touched on. First of all, as to the Maple Grove home, I would note that Maple Grove home was not protected under the antenuptial. It's not listed at all in the antenuptial. As council appeared to argue. As to the discussion of income with Mr.
So in your view, the antenuptial only applies to the assets that are listed in Exhibit A?
Yes. I think
there's nothing listed for wife in Exhibit B.
Right. Yes. That is how I read the antenuptial, yes. As to the discussion of income with Mr. Kiwus that council touched on, the district court specifically stated that David Kiwus had stated in his testimony that the parties didn't earn enough income to support their living expenses during the time that they were constructing the home. However, Mr. Kiwus specifically stated when he was asked about this, I don't know what their living expenses were. So he didn't have that information to actually make that statement, and he made that very, very clear in that discussion. Also, this ignores the fact that Mr. Slag was self-employed. In looking at that exhibit, it appears that it was looking only at the party's personal taxes and not business taxes. And of course, as we know, a person who is self-employed can do things on their tax returns to make it look on their personal taxes like they did have less income. And I'd point out as to...
If the consideration wasn't adequate, but the other factors were met, would the agreement still be valid?
I think because it's a balancing test, that the fact that the lack of consideration was so egregious, the court certainly could find that is enough to say that it was unfair.
Can you respond to appellant's argument that there was adequate consideration under the provisions of the antenuptial agreement?
Sure. I think that relies, as you discussed, on that Hafner case. And I think the district court relied on that as well.
I think I asked respondents to articulate what they thought was the actual consideration. I mean, the district court focused on Hafner and didn't really focus on the benefit of the bargain, in my view anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And respondents, I think, articulated what they believe is the benefit of the bargain. So can you respond to their argument regarding that?
So what I heard as the benefit of the bargain was that Ms. Gooby was lived in a station that she perhaps might not have had she not been married to Mr. Slag. However, I'd argue that that is not the consideration that the court is to look at. The court is to look at the consideration that is provided for in the antenuptial, not that the parties' lives as they were married might have been different had they not been married. It's specifically as to whether the financially disadvantaged spouse was provided for. And so here I'd argue that she clearly was not.
Well, in Kramer, didn't the court consider that wife help with the operation of the farm and maintaining the household and cared for the couple's child, and then said we cannot conclude that the consideration wife received for executing this agreement was anywhere near adequate. So it appears that the court considered both the terms of the agreement and the couple's living situation and work situation during the course of the marriage to determine whether the consideration was adequate.
And I think in the court's discussion in Kramer, they were looking at whether wife was provided for, given everything that she had done during the marriage. Not necessarily that she received something during the marriage, but she had contributed to the parties in the sense that she was a stay-at-home parent, and she did take care of the farm, as you mentioned. But it wasn't looking at what did she receive during the marriage. It was looking at what did she provide during the marriage, and found that she was not provided for again in the antenuptial. There was one other point that I also wanted to point to. There was some discussion as to the district court's finding as to credibility. And so I understand that is likely a big discussion here, and so I would like to focus on that. I'd point out that the credibility determination is a finding of fact that must be not clearly erroneous, just like any other finding of fact. And here, as my time looks to be about out, I'd just point out that my brief does expand on this in detail as to what points were actually contrary to what Mr. Slag was arguing and actually support Ms. Gooby's arguments here. If I have no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nixon. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days in writing. That is the final case on today's oral argument calendar, so the court is now in recess.